allies could breathe a sigh of relief. The same Donald Trump who stayed away from the G7 showing up on time for the NATO summit in the Netherlands, an abridged summit to curry favor and keep his undivided attention. He got to sleep at the Royal Palace. The U.S. president played with members' nerves. He entertained suspense over the United States' commitment to NATO's Article 5, though in the end he reaffirmed support for the alliance's all-for-one and one-for-all clause in case of attack. And after a victory lap over Iran, Trump all smiles over alliance members' commitment to boost defense spending to 5% of GDP. That is, most of them. We'll hear about the outliers. Promises were made, and there were purchases announced. Britain buying 12 F-35A fighter jets made in the U.S. of A. Music to Trump's ears. But how will that announcement go down with the likes of France, which has been arguing for Europe to reduce its dependency on Washington? And then, of course, there's Ukraine. Trump, in the end, taking the meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky. Some mixed messages there, too, both when it comes to Russia's relentless campaign of aggression and the benefit of the doubt that's so often been granted by Trump to Vladimir Putin. Today in the France 24 debate, how far will flattery go with NATO's biggest power? With us, he's former NATO Director of Policy Planning, Fabrice Potier, CEO of the consultancy Rasmussen Global. Good to see you in Paris.
Good to see you.
Thanks for being with us. Thanks as well for joining us to Andre Dietrich, Senior Analyst at the European Union Institute for Security Studies think tank. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
From Washington, Ivana Stradner, Research Fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies think tank. Good to see you.
So wonderful to see you.
And from The Hague, Rafael Loss, Defense Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
You can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, Donald Trump never wanted to shy away from hyperbole, the president of the United States hailing the tremendous things accomplished at the summit in The Hague. And speaking of hyperbole, well, even going in, we had the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, setting the tone with a text message to Trump that the U.S. president screenshot and retweeted on his Truth Social account. In it, he says, "You're flying into another big success. You will achieve something no American president in decades could get done. Europe is going to pay in a big way, as they should, and it will be your win." But wait, there's more from the Dutch prime minister, like when the pair alluded to the F-bomb that Trump dropped the previous day when he told Israel and Iran to honor his ceasefire.
They're not going to be fighting each other. They've had it. They've had a big fight, like two kids in a schoolyard. You know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easier to stop them.
And then daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
You have to use strong language. Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
And before we go to our panel, let's go to France 24 International Affairs editor Kenavan Gorgestani, reporting from that summit that has just concluded. Kenavan, how did the daddy remark go down?
Well, first of all, it drew a lot of laughter from the reporters here at The Hague, at the NATO summit. But it also caused Mark Rutte a little bit of a grilling from reporters during his closing press conference, with reporters asking him whether all of this over-imposed flattery, praising Donald Trump, calling him or referring to him as the daddy over the schoolyard, and all of the other things that he has said about Donald Trump and those text messages, whether that made him look weak, whether it was a little bit ridiculous and over the top. So he got quite a bit of criticism, but he dismissed that criticism from the press by simply saying that Donald Trump deserved all of the praise he was getting. He insisted that he believed that no other president could have done this, that it was thanks to Donald Trump's pressure over the past months, but also over the past years, that the allies managed to agree, or maybe were forced into agreeing to increase their defense spending to 5%. So Mark Rutte taking the heat for what he did, and probably calculating saying that it was worth getting criticized by the press if it would keep the U.S. president happy during this very short summit.
Kedavan Gorgestani, many thanks for reporting live there from The Hague. Let me give you Andre Dietrich. Yeah, you at any NATO summit, the United States is, what, two-thirds of the budget of NATO? You have to treat with a certain amount of deference the biggest contributor to the club. Did they have to go this far?
That's a good question. I think I wouldn't over-focus on the details, on one particular statement by the Secretary General or not. But
it wasn't just that, one.
And, you know, let's say aesthetic choices aside, I think the larger question is whether this sort of flattery, which might work quite well in, you know, Mr. Trump's court, works equally well in international negotiations with partners. Because my personal sense is that Mr. Trump really listens when an argument is made on the basis of interest, you know, and depends on who has the cards. This kind of flattery, when we, in the end, you know, we are happy, we have the declaration, and the commitment on the 5% spending is an incredibly important one. But there's also this huge respite because we you know, were able to agree on something that should basically be common sense. So we may not come out as really the strongest party here, and it may not be the Europe's finest hour in the end. You know.
Now, the reporters asked the French president this question. He says, no, when I speak to Donald Trump, I don't fawn. I just argue the point, as Andre was just saying. Still, France is a nuclear power. If you're one of the smaller members of NATO, a bit of fawning can't hurt, right?
Well, I think there's a difference between flattery, which is what the NATO Secretary General has to do to an extent, especially when the ego like Donald Trump, and creepy. And I think the comment, the daddy comment, is obviously more on the creepy side than on the flattery. But putting that aside, I think what it tells you about this summit is that the number one and only objective of the summit was and is to keep the U.S. in. And in that sense, Mark Rutte has achieved his objective. He's kept the U.S. in. He's kept Donald Trump inside the summit room without going into, you know, off script and without wrecking like the G7 or other forum like this. So he's achieved his goal. However, it leaves many questions unanswered. What's our strategy vis-a-vis Russia? This is something the U.S. didn't want to have on the agenda. What's also our strategy with and vis-a-vis Ukraine? And Ukraine is there as a recipient, but not there as a soon-to-be members. And so I think the big question that's still out there, and in a way, the Trump administration is leaving those questions to the Europeans, but the Europeans have to do both huge spending increase and solving some pretty big strategic things.
All right. Whether or not it's creepy, what is for certain, Ivana Stradner, is we've never seen a NATO summit like this one before.
Indeed, you're right. I would actually not focus so much on all those media hits, bombastic words. Instead, we should really focus what matters, and that is that NATO pledged to increase funding, that also the Trump administration fully supported Article 5, given after years and years of Europeans worrying whether Washington would support Europe and NATO in general. I think this is a step in the right direction.
But is it only as good? Is it only until the next NATO summit, and we'll have the same suspense again, and we'll have to keep the meetings even shorter to keep his attention?
I think it's important really to follow his deeds, not his words only. But nevertheless, I think it's important to give a credit where credit is due, because Europe has been complaining for a long time that we would not even support Article 5. One thing that Trump is absolutely also right is to question the definition of NATO. And I think that it's also past time for NATO to discuss what is Article 5. Because if you look at Russia, Russia is waging a new generation of warfare. They do not understand the war in the same way that we do. They combine cyber attacks, they combine information attacks. So just look at his sabotage activities across Europe. So I think it's also very important to have a firm stance on that and to counter our adversaries in the way that they understand war. And finally, my last point is, this is very important also to send a signal, not only to Russia, but Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran have created something that's called the axis of aggressors. So it is very important to send firm words and firm commitments.
Unless Rafael Loss, the conclusion of Vladimir Putin takes from this summit is, well, if I tell Donald Trump just how great he is, I'll get my way when it comes to Ukraine in any negotiation.
I think beyond the flattery and rhetorical acrobatics that we've seen that sort of made this summit historic indeed, there's an undercurrent of enormous transformation going back to an ambition first expressed by NATO's first Supreme Allied Commander and then U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower to shift the burden of defending Europe to Europeans and to have the United States play a supporting role to European efforts. If you look at the past couple of summits going back to Madrid, over Vilnius, to Washington, to now The Hague, then allies adopted a new strategic concept. They've adopted the most specific, concrete defense plans in a generation, and now they've got the capability targets that were just approved and adopted by defense ministers a couple of weeks ago, and leaders have now committed to put up the money. We'll see defense burden shifting to Europeans over the next couple of years, 2029 as a major milestone, as expressed in the communique. But that, as Fabrice suggested, requires Europeans to tackle the dual challenge of not only taking on the major burden of defending Europe, but also leading on a political strategy and a military strategy to defend Ukraine against continued Russian aggression.
Yeah, defending Europe, allies leveling up, as the panel's saying, by buying American, the UK prime minister announcing his intention to buy 12 US-made F-35A fighter jets capable of carrying nuclear warheads, jets that will be joining NATO's shared airborne nuclear mission.
We have now taken decisive action in relation to the F-35A. That's the right decision for our country. It's the right decision for NATO. And it really comes at an important point in a volatile world where we do need a stronger, more diverse, resilient security.
Now, Fabrice Potier, British buying what the French call, I guess you could translate this as the snooping airplane, because it's a connected airplane, and so you need the United States, or the United States can at any time ground your operation if it doesn't like it. How do the French feel about the British buying more American-made jets?
Well, I think behind the headline of the UK announcing the 12 extra F-35, even the Brits themselves are already looking at non-American solutions. They know very well that if they want some form of independence, autonomy, and also to become more European, they will have to move away or to de-risk themselves from some of the dependence they have towards US weapon systems and platforms. So I think this was a smart move by Keir Starmer to show, you know, we are still the first friend of the United States in Europe. It makes sense because they want to rebuild the air component of their nuclear forces. But down the line, I think many other purchases that the British are going to do will probably be much more European. And don't forget, there are also many UK companies that have big foothold in Europe. So I think we should not read too much beyond him trying to show we are still transatlantic, we're still the special relationship, but in the deep state of both the British defense sector and the British government, I think there's a notion we need to go more European.
Are you seeing the signs of that, André, of the British wanting to go more European?
I do, with this kind of deepening defense integration. By the way, of course, it's not only the Brits, but also a number of EU member states who are interested in procuring F-35. Some may have already, but even in Central Europe, the Poles, the Czechs. So it's not just the Brits. But my sense is that, yes, that the Brits are very much interested. interested in, it has to do with what Fabrice says also. I mean, there is a degree of integration already in the defense industry, defense industrial cooperation, which the EU is very, very much interested in.
But the next generation stealth fighter jet is still on the drawing board, the one that the French, the British, and the Germans want to build.
And there are many, many, many other systems which we can develop and build and procure together, sure.
All right. Donald Trump insisting on his allies raising their contributions to NATO, but he never seems to go into why they need to raise their commitment. Our panel has, and his French counterpart stated the unsaid.
Let me remind you and put this back in the middle of discussions, because there is a Russian threat. I said a couple of months ago to our fellow citizens, for years now, we have been living through the third Russian war in Europe, which brings this threat.
All right, so Ivana Stradner, leveling up because Russia's at the doorstep. But that's not what Donald Trump says. Does he give an explanation as to why he wants NATO members to pay more?
He did not explain in detail why he wants NATO to spend more, but he is also very clear that Europe should also protect itself from its own threats coming from neighbors, including Russia. So I think Macron is absolutely right. But one thing that also the Trump administration also emphasized multiple times is that Europe has to also have capabilities to protect itself. We also have problems with here in Washington, D.C. with Iran, with China. So we would be, I think, very content to see Europe being able to defend itself. And the second thing is, as I mentioned, you just mentioned Russia, but Russia doesn't need to roll tanks and jets in any of the Western capitals, whether Paris or Brussels or London. I'm very worried what's happening right now in the Baltic stage. Just take a look at what's happening in Estonia. Russia is already setting informational conditions over there. We have sabotage activities. We have in the West. We have cyber activities. So we really have to pay more attention, because Putin's ultimate goal, let's zoom out, is to show that NATO is a paper tiger. Russian ally Serbia, actually there was an attack on NATO peacekeepers several years ago, where according to Reuters report, 19 NATO peacekeepers were injured. What did NATO do? Nothing. They sent just a pathetic statement how greatly concerned they are. I would not be surprised to see Putin testing NATO Article 5 right below the threshold of war to make sure that we do not respond. So we absolutely have to be ready to deter Russia, not only with words, but deeds. And it requires not only money, but more importantly, political will.
Rafael Loss, you agree we should be expecting sooner than later some kind of a test, someplace like the exclave of Kaliningrad or the Baltic states?
I think we all agree that we're not at peace in Europe at this point in time. Russian hybrid campaigns, disinformation, political influence campaigns, assassination attempts, actual assassinations have taken place across Europe for some years. We do face Russia's nuclear-backed imperialism since 2008-2014, the attack on Georgia, the annexation of Crimea, Russia's meddling in Donbass. So this is a long-term persistent threat that Europe is facing. The Hague's communique does reflect that recognition. All 32 allies again sign up to that recognition. And I think being aware that further testing with military instruments is something that is not impossible to foresee, but where deterrence efforts, including generating deterrence by greater defense spending, can minimize such a window of opportunity to arise for Russia.
All right. And that brings us back to what's going on at Europe's doorstep in Ukraine. Tuesday's ballistic missile strike on the central Dnipro region, a reminder of the brutality of the war there. At least 17 killed. Donald Trump agreeing to meet his Ukrainian counterpart on the sidelines of the NATO summit. Trump, who qualified the closed-door encounter with Volodymyr Zelensky as positive, even leaving the door open to selling Patriot anti-missile systems to Kyiv, but refusing to commit to more military aid behind what's currently planned. Doesn't mean he won't do it, but he certainly isn't saying so for the time being. A couple of questions for you, Fabrice Potier. First of all, the format. This time, it wasn't a public spectacle, which they've had private meetings since that blow-up in February at the White House that we all remember. And also, is there any point in trying to interpret what Donald Trump is saying in moments like these?
I think the challenge here is that you don't see a dramatic positive change of Trump's position on Ukraine. It's actually more or less status quo, meaning no more military aid for free, at least. No more U.S. sanctions against Russia. Mark Rubio said it clearly, which means we are not going to have peace through strength because we don't want to exert strength against the main war party and the one that has provoked the war, which is Vladimir Putin's Russia. So and his only interest, quite frankly, is to align his interests and values with Russia. I think we should not see, it's not just realpolitik here. I think there's a strong strand in the Donald Trump administration, starting with him, but also his vice president, that, you know, we have a strong value alignment with Vladimir Putin's Russia. And they want to do it one way or another. So it can be with the Europeans or above the Europeans' heads and the Ukrainians. And this is where the Europeans have a really difficult call here, because they have to be able to solve that huge problem almost on their own. And I think the Patriot Interceptors conversation is about Europe buying U.S. Patriot Interceptors so that the Ukrainians have what it takes, what they need, to basically defend their and protect, mostly protect their civilian population and their critical infrastructure.
Yeah, and we heard Volodymyr Zelensky afterwards in his readout of what happened, talking up things like joint production of drones. But again, is that going to be enough to get Donald Trump on board? Is the needle moving?
I'm not sure it is. I do agree here that we're basically stuck. You know, nothing seems to be changing. It's extremely unlikely that this diplomatic outreach by President Trump will result in any sort of diplomatic breakthrough. The U.S. position seems to be fairly stable for the time being, which is unfortunate, because without pressuring Mr. Putin closer to a position where we can, the Ukrainians first of all, and we as well, agree on some sort of acceptable ceasefire, this is something that will be very difficult to do without the United States. And that's very uncomfortable. But at least for the time being, I think what can be done and attempted is, yes, exactly, air defense systems, the Patriots. You know, the U.S. is not the main provider of those in terms of numbers of air defenses, but these Patriots seems to be quite effective and more effective than, unfortunately, the European systems that are being delivered to Ukraine. And perhaps you've noticed there was this press conference and a question asked by a reporter of Ukrainian origin. And
she got to
Mr. Trump, I think, on some sort of emotional level. And he said, yeah, I'll look into that. So, well, we'll see. But this is really about, you know, saving lives. Mm. You know, this is not about strategy as much as really saving lives. And I think I can, of course, only speculate on this, but when Mr. Zelensky met Mr. Trump, I think it's a positive signal that they actually met. I would assume that, you know, Mr. Zelensky's objective is to sort of maintain a certain maintenance or limits of Mr. Trump's thinking on Ukraine and Russia, however difficult that is, so he doesn't go too far in some direction. And then, yes, bring to the table the issue of the air defenses, of HIMARS, of these critical systems or intelligence that the U.S. still, that it has provided and that is very hard to replace.
Ivana Stradner, of course, there's always a domestic calculus when a president makes a decision, particularly on defense and military matters. So have the events of the last week been kind of an acid test? We saw play out rivalries within the Trump camp over the bombing campaign in Iran between traditional Republicans and the more isolationist far-right wing of the party. What's your conclusion you draw as to who at the end of the day, if push comes to shove, if there is the kind of provocation you described earlier on the part of Vladimir Putin, who would win the argument domestically where you are?
I think there are a lot of words for domestic arguments in politics in general. So this is precisely why actions speak louder than words. But nevertheless, I think it's too early to predict, you know, how the Trump administration would react. But nevertheless, based on what I see, I think there are still a lot of voices that would support Trump to do what is right thing to do. In terms of Russia,
did the traditional Republican wing of the party win the argument after what happened in Iran last week?
I mean, it's too early to say, right? So, because it's still ongoing, there are voices, you know, on both sides. But the Trump administration is going basically along, you know, with the traditional Republicans. So I would never absolutely portray Donald Trump as someone who is isolationist. On the contrary, like I would say that President Trump, even when it comes to Russia, he's trying to be very pragmatic. I think what he does not understand is how actually Russia, how Putin thinks. Putin is not willing to negotiate. For Putin, this is a protracted war. He wants to exhaust Washington. He wants to exhaust Europe and to make sure that we do not support Ukraine. And that's precisely why President Trump should send all the weapons that Ukraine needs to send a credible signal to Russia if he truly wants to make America great again. The second thing is, as per Putin's nuclear threats, unfortunately, it's still, you know, something that is resonating with a lot of people in the West. And we have to understand that it's a pure propaganda that Russia has been peddling because out of fear of potential Armageddon. So we do not support Ukraine. And the third point that I want to emphasize is related to sanctions. I think not only the United States, but also Europe has to ramp up its sanctions. There is still gas floating in Europe coming from Russia. And in terms of the United States, I think what Trump is trying to do is to buy more time in terms of negotiations, not to punish Russia right now, but to buy more time with negotiations. My opinion is that Putin is absolutely not willing and not ready to negotiate. On the contrary, we saw that every time after his meetings with Washington, he actually attacks even more civilians to make sure that we do not respond. I do believe that eventually President Trump will figure out that Putin is trying to play him like a fiddle, so he will eventually respond. And we also have to understand that Putin has been trying for a long time to show that our alliance is gone. And our center of gravity is indeed alliance. So I think it's very important also for President Trump to deliver a message, what he delivered today, that we are standing together.
On this point, Rafael Loss, there is perhaps a turning point, and we've seen it in your native Germany, what with increase in defense spending already under the previous government. And now we've had the defense minister in the last couple of days saying that with this leveling up of Germany's military, if it doesn't go far enough, he gave an interview to public broadcaster ARD saying they might even bring back conscription. Is it really going to come to that?
It might. Germany has been discussing reforming its personnel structure of the armed forces for quite some time. I was surprised to hear at the NATO public forum these past couple of days the shower of praise for Germany from Secretary General Mark Rutte to U.S. Ambassador to NATO Matthew Whitaker, all saying that Germany's efforts to increase defense spending at a rapid pace, reaching 3.5% by 2029, is something that could meaningfully move NATO Europe forward, because Germany is Europe's biggest economic power and most populous country, of course. So money for Germany will not be a problem, most likely in the near future, as it is rearming. there are other problems though that it is facing. One is the terribly inefficient procurement system, and one is the issue of how to get enough people into the armed forces. And conscription is being identified as one potential fix to that, even though reinstituting conscription like it existed in Germany until 2011 would probably not solve those problems. It would rather raise questions of intergenerational justice, of gender equality, and others that quickly would bring any kind of effort like that to Germany's constitutional court. So policymakers are well advised to think more broadly about a kind of service obligation for people young and old to spend a year or so of their life serving others, serving their communities, building trust with each other, and learning new skills to make Germany a society broadly more resilient, because the crises of the future, whether they relate to an Article 5 attack of Russia against NATO or a natural disaster or some other crisis that might hit German society, would require those kinds of skills and those kind of societal trust that can be brought about by service obligations.
Fabrice Potier, we saw the German Chancellor and the French President, together they penned a piece, kind of dull reading actually, in the Financial Times. It was dry reading, let's put it that way. But, you know, they talked about the need to level up in a volatile world. Is this really the moment, or is this just talk at this point?
Well, first, much better reading than the last piece Macron penned with Scholz, where you could see a lot of misalignments. Here, it was very official, very institutional language, but you could see a clear alignment of what really matters, what we need to get right. So I will not be so dismissive. I think you have an alignment between Brussels, Berlin, Paris, that you have not had for almost a decade. So I think it needs to be welcome. What needs to be done, the paradox is for the French, by the end of this decade, in principle, Germany will have a defense budget that is twice the size of the French budget. And I think France is going to have to think, what does it mean for us? Because France has this position of being the prime military power, and obviously will remain a military nuclear power. But in terms of mass, of both equipment but also armed forces, there's going to be a kind of shift of the gravity center. And for the French, I think they will have to ask themselves some real question about how do we stay relevant in the conventional warfare, not just nuclear, but conventional. How do we still be the leading military power or the co-leading military power? So there's a real question which is going to touch some historic nerves. And I think the French will really have to think hard, and my bet, they have to go European. There's still too much legacy and inhibition in Paris to play the real European defense card. They talk about Europe, but they don't do European defense. We are still very French-focused or very focused on non-European markets.
So are you predicting there will be a compromise on this stealth aircraft?
I don't know about that. It might be that some of those programs are never going to see the daylight. But the bottom line, I think the French, if they still want to matter, and if they want us to build a real European critical mass, they will have to become more European in their action, both industrial but also political action.
Now, before going to the NATO summit, André Dietrich, the French president, was in Norway. And it was interesting because part of the reason he went was to sell frigates. He's trying to sell boats to the Norwegian Navy. And he talked about selling it at cost. Our correspondent, Ketevan Gorgestani, we heard at the beginning, was saying how, you know, as these countries level up, they don't want to spend blindly. And is that the way to answer Fabrice Potier's question about how the French do it, promoting this idea of doing things at cost? Because we've seen the Ukrainians do it, particularly with their drone program.
I'm not expert on the defense sales, but one thing I think is very clear is, you know, state-of-art military systems, they are incredibly expensive. And as we try to level up and increase our level of deterrence, which is what NATO is all about, but also on the EU side, but this goes maybe more immediately to being more resilient against Russia's hybrid threats, which are also mentioned in this context. Yes, I mean, we don't have unlimited resources, so we have to find ways of spending together. And by the way, I think it's also important to increase trust, because Fabrice mentioned that, you know, that the French will have to find a way to sort of come to terms with this new coming reality of much militarily stronger Germany. But it's not just the French, you know, it's also Central Europeans, the Poles, the Czechs, and the historic nerve, you know, is present there as well.
Is there still that historic nerve?
There is.
And on that point, the other point that Fabrice made was about conventional stuff. And I know the Czechs were at the heart of this initiative to just do something very simple, which is provide more bullets for Ukraine. How's that going?
Artillery munitions, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's gone quite well. It was, I would say, you know, a very Czech way of
because
doing
when we
things.
See, so just when we see how quickly Russia has gone into overdrive with a wartime economy.
Yes. But now, by the way, I think Ukraine, it's not just the Russians who make more artillery shells than the EU member states, but it's also Ukraine that makes more artillery shells. So there are these lasting dependencies that we mentioned before on some critical assistance provided by the United States, but the Ukrainians have done immense job in stepping up their defense production. And then, of course, there is the Danish model. There is the Czech munition initiative. It was, I would say, you know, very Czech in the sense that the Czechs were quite creative, I think, in finding ways to find these munitions, to get other partners to chip in, you know, to fund it by enlarged and refit it by enlarged in the Czech Republic and send them to the front line. And I think it's been quite successful. I do hope that it will continue.
All right, the cost of leveling up, in case you haven't gotten the message from our panel, is high. And just ask the French, by the way, who have a massive budget deficit. Neighboring Spain, though, pushing back. The socialists are in a coalition with the far left, and they have drawn the ire of the U.S. president for having said that his country won't raise its defense spending to 5% of GDP. Donald Trump warning Pedro Sanchez that, quote, we're negotiating a trade deal, we're going to make them pay. Madrid drawing heat from more than just the United States.
I would like to underline that there are no opt-outs whatsoever. Everybody accepts the same text. It's a matter of interpretation. You have to do the 5% and the capabilities. And the interpretation of Spain is that they can realize the capabilities without doing 3.5% of the GDP. This remains to be seen.
So basically Belgium saying, if they don't have to pay 5%, why should we pay 5%?
Yeah, I think this was a rather embarrassing moment by Pedro Sanchez, who was trying to appease his growing domestic opposition, including in his own coalition and in his own party because of a corruption scandal, trying to appease his political base by basically the result is appeasing Putin by saying, you know, I'm a full-fledged member of the alliance, but I don't want and I don't need to spend 3.5 plus 1.5. And I think that was an embarrassing moment. It was quite unusual that the heads of state had decided to break silence on the draft of the communique by leaking the break of silence, the breach of silence in El País. So there was a very Sanchez way of communicating his discontent as a way for him to show that he's standing for the left-wing coalition. But the result was to show and to send a signal to Putin that maybe the Europeans are still not really serious about it. And I think it was Trump was completely entitled to arrive in The Hague pretty angry, thinking, you know what, you still don't get it. 3.5 is not to please me, even though I think he's quite pleased and he thinks it's thanks to him. But 3.5 is for our own security in Europe.
Ivana Stradner, seen from Washington, is this just, on the one hand, is this kind of like on NATO's like carting frogs in a wheelbarrow? Or do you say to yourself, well, at the end of the day, Spain, okay, but what matters most is the likes of Germany, France, Britain, Italy, Poland?
I absolutely agree that there is a lot of talk for domestic audience, and we should wait and see. But the most important thing is, as you mentioned, I think that we expect a lot of work from the leading states in NATO to do more. And as I mentioned, I truly don't believe that this war in Ukraine is going to stay at Ukraine, because Putin is working very, very hard to truly test NATO NATO and Europe in his own way of a hybrid war. So when things escalate further, not if, but when, I think then we are going to see how states will respond, because actions speak louder than words. And my final point for that is that Putin understands only one thing, which is the language of power. Kindness is weakness.
Rafael Loss, did you hear that? It's not if, but when Vladimir Putin will escalate further.
There are reports from Western intelligence agencies that point to a lot of urgency in Europe's rearmament efforts. Now, they usually also attach some conditions to that. And one of them is how the war in Ukraine proceeds and potentially concludes at whatever point in time and under whatever conditions. Another one is how fast Europe can actually rearm. If the war in Ukraine ends to Russia's favor and Europe does not get going on rearming, spending, and producing the capabilities and troops to deter and defend against Russian attack, then yes, we open up a window of opportunity for Vladimir Putin to go beyond the kinds of hybrid activities that we've described and to push the military aggression onto NATO territory.
Now, Andrei Dietrich, a lot of people watching this show will be saying all this talk about an imminent threat. It's all stirred up by what we call in France cannon salesmen, that this is great for the defense industry, and that's why this is all happening.
Look, the threat is absolutely real. Putin's Russia may not have the capability to launch an overt aggression against a member state in a few years' time. We've seen how the military has been doing in Ukraine. It's been, of course, innovating and learning a whole lot, but the threat is there, the impulse is there, and unless we scale up our deterrence, this is a very real case scenario. Now, I think, I mean, we now have in the declaration the reconfirmation of Article 5. That's all very, very nice. Until next time. But I think deterrence is basically, it's a function of these political declarations, of capabilities and of planning. And with the Trump administration, I think the relative credibility of the common defense pledge may have decreased. And the Russians know it. At the same time, there is a lot of uncertainty. They don't have the capability right now. Even a few years down the road, they may not be certain whether the U.S. would be involved in one of those scenarios, you know, of open aggression against one of the Baltic countries. If the U.S. get involved and they command the air, that goes very, very badly, of course, for Russians. So I think actually what we may expect and what we may see as much more likely is one of those sort of hybrid warfare, sometimes something very serious, not just, you know, disinformation campaigns, but something very serious attacking the sovereignty of a member state, in which Russia will try to test, to learn from how we respond and try to undermine our resolve and our cohesion.
It's the job to look for worst-case scenarios if you're working on defense and you work with the defense departments, defense ministries. But is this alarmist?
No, I think it's pretty accurate. And like the other interviewee mentioned, is the war extends beyond Ukraine. And it's another kind of war. It's a hybrid war where Vladimir Putin is both testing us, testing our resolve, and trying to keep us on our back foot. So we are destabilized both politically, in our critical infrastructure, in our network. And we should not underestimate that these tests can be the prelude to something else, if he chooses to be. What we should realize is his mindset. He's sitting in Moscow, looking at the US president, considering the possibility of annexing NATO territory, i.e. Greenland and even Canada. So he thinks, he probably feels vindicated in his illegal annexation of Crimea, and he probably feels that another small annexation of some small part of the NATO territory, for example, to reconnect better Mother Russia with the exclave of Kaliningrad, that maybe politically nowadays could be doable. So, and Putin is a very pragmatic, very persistent man who wants to fulfill his vision of recreating the Soviet Union. So Trump introduced a new interesting proposition for him. So therefore, we should be, I think, on the more alarmist mode, because we have underestimated Vladimir Putin for too long.
Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Fabrice Potier, I want to thank you. I want to thank André Dietrich as well. Rafael Loss for being with us from that NATO summit in The Hague. Ivana Stradner in Washington, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.